Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3071, United States of America versus Socorro D. Johnson, also known as Rocco, appellant. Mr. Kramer for the appellant, Ms. Chasson for the appellee.
Good morning, Mr. Kramer.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Well, I think there's four issues in this case, all pointing to why Mr. Johnson did not receive a fair trial in this case. And while I think they're all equally meritorious and equally clear, I guess I'll start like any defense lawyer, which is backwards, and start with the Brady issue, which, first of all, I think there's almost no evidence I can think of that would be more exculpatory than somebody else admitting that they owned the drugs that were found in this case. Admittedly, it didn't go as far as saying that Mr. Johnson didn't know anything about them, but it certainly didn't give any indication that Mr. Johnson knew anything about them. And an admission of ownership by somebody else would have been powerful evidence. I think especially powerful in the sense that the district court applied the wrong test for Brady. There's no question the district court applied the wrong test. At page 132 of the appendix, the district court said, there is not a reasonable probability that disclosing the evidence would have resulted in a verdict of acquittal. In a 28J letter I sent that I hope reached the court, a few months ago, the Supreme Court said that the test is whether there is a reasonable probability that the withheld evidence would have altered at least one juror's assessment.
That was in regard to sentencing.
Well, it was in regard to both, actually. In Cohn versus Bell, they repeated that.
I just wonder whether it makes a difference. This is the Souter opinion?
This is the Souter opinion, which twice says, the court then said, if the suppressed evidence might have persuaded one or more jurors. That was a death penalty case, admittedly. Right. But the defense claimed both that the withheld evidence affected the guilt phase and the sentencing phase.
Is it the one juror part that you think is different?
Pardon me? Yes.
So I just was wondering about that. I haven't found that language in any previous opinion.
Well, let me put it this way. It's the Supreme Court's most recent pronouncement.
No, I got that. But on the other hand, they don't suggest that they're announcing a test different than Kyle or different than any of the other cases.
Well, I think...
You think it's different than the... You think they've announced a new test for Brady?
No, I think the district court got it wrong when it said would have resulted in a verdict of acquittal. The test has always been would have had a different result or affected the trial. Could be a hung jury just as easily as an acquittal.
So you're not focusing on the one juror language as particularly different than the question of the result.
Right, when the district court in this case says in a verdict of acquittal, the Supreme Court has clearly encompassed the hung jury within a different result.
What do you think a reasonable probability is? You know what a high probability is, and we know what a low probability is, and maybe we know what a medium, but what is a reasonable probability?
Well, it's tough to say. This court said it's not a preponderance, let me put it that way, so it's lower than 50%. If you consider a preponderance 51%, it's something lower than that. You have the whole defense in
enough to undermine confidence in the verdict,
or at least one juror's confidence.
That's totally circular, right?
That's true.
What undermines your confidence? Reasonable probability that the result might be different. So.
Well, what undermines the? I actually agree with you. I mean, I've never quite understood the whole.
It's a weasel word that the Supreme Court has never defined. I have another question before you move on. The material that was not disclosed was an affidavit and a search warrant?
There was an affidavit and a search warrant, yes. And then also there was an interview with the confidential informant. So there were two things.
Well, neither one of those items could be introduced, right?
No, the affidavit and the search warrant could clearly be introduced. The district court.
But it's for the truth of what was asserted? That's third-hand hearsay.
No, that's what this court said in United States versus Warren, that if the government relies upon an affidavit and a sworn search warrant to go to a judge for a warrant based on a sworn affidavit, that's admissible.
In another case?
Sure, yes.
Really?
Well, I mean, in any case. If it's admissible evidence because the government has established its reliability by relying upon it to present it to a judge.
For the truth of the proposition asserted?
Yes, for the truth of the matter asserted. That's what Warren was about. Now, admittedly, that was in the same case, but it doesn't make any distinction between
that case. It wasn't called upon to make a distinction.
But it's also admissible, I think, as a
statement against
admission against penal interest, yes. So I think it's admissible on two independent grounds. Let me put it this way. The district.
Does it matter to you whether, in fact, that affidavit would be admissible or not admissible?
No. I think in the end, no. But before.
Because Brady is not restricted to admissible evidence, right?
No. There's clearly case law that says that because it could lead to admissible evidence or lead a defense lawyer down a path where they could find stuff. But let me go back and answer your question another way also. The district court found it would be admissible, and the government, neither in the district court nor in this court, has contested that fact, that right. It would be admissible.
Let me ask you about something else the court said in its order, post-trial order, about, I read it to say that he needed, in order for it to be Brady, it needed to be completely exculpatory. He said something like, and anyway, this doesn't completely absolve him.
He said two things. He said completely exculpatory. He said it's not completely exculpatory and it's not fully exculpatory. So he said it not just once but twice. I don't know what that means, frankly, and it's certainly not even close to the Brady test. Brady test is any helpful or favorable evidence. So, I mean, I think the district court made a lot of mistakes. I'm sorry.
Well, to follow up on that question, I wanted to ask you, do you think the degree of exculpation or favorability is under the first prong of Brady or under the materiality prong of Brady?
I think it's under the materiality prong. Evidence that's in any degree favorable, helpful, exculpatory has to be disclosed. The question, if it's not, then becomes the materiality. And certainly, I mean, there's a number of cases that say impeachment evidence that's just cumulative is not material. So that's a degree. So I think that's encompassed in the materiality.
Do you think it's possible he was thinking if it's not fully exculpatory, it's not material? He didn't say that.
Well, he put that, though, in his discussion at the beginning, not in the materiality section. So I also think that he made major mistakes in focusing just on the government's case and what the government said and not realizing how the defense lawyer would have used this. The theme of the defense was that they're not his drugs. They don't belong to him. He didn't possess them. Clearly, if you had somebody admitting ownership of this big stash of heroin.
How would you have gotten it in? That's all I'm asking.
How would you have gotten it in? You introduced the affidavit. I mean, that gets back to the admissibility. You introduced the affidavit.
You wouldn't introduce this evidence through a witness?
Well, I think you'd do a number. Well, on the record here, you would simply put the affidavit in. What the district court the district court kept focusing on the government's case, never considered how the defense lawyer would have used it. You go out and you ask the government for the name of the informant. You talk to him. You call the informant as a witness and say that the Cinquan Blakely admitted to me that this heroin belonged to him. And by the way, it was almost exactly the amount that was in the room.
That was my next question. Yeah, are we certain there wasn't? The affidavit didn't say where in the house he stored it, did it?
It did not. He said that heroin belonged to me that was found in the search. So it's clear, but it was also almost exactly the same amount. He said, I put a half kilo and it was 519 grams. 500 grams is half a kilo. So it matched almost exactly.
All the stuff in that bag that was, and then there was a bag with a box and vials and all.
Yes.
That, was that all heroin?
That was all. The bag that contained the shoebox that contained, yes, the heroin, that contained another bag and some plastic, that was the heroin. It was out in the room amongst laundry baskets in the room that was a complete mess, as the agents described it. So, you do a number of things. You call the informant as a witness to testify that Mr. Blakeney admitted that those drugs were his, that they belonged to him. There was no indication, and that Mr. Blakeney never said that Mr. Johnson knew anything about them. This part about Mr. Johnson having to take the beef could certainly be interpreted as, he's going to take the fall, even though he's not guilty, for my crime. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways. You might find evidence in Mr. Blakeney's case. I mean, unfortunately, none of this is in the record. The district judge just cut it off by issuing a ruling, but you might go to Mr. Blakeney's case file and find materials supporting it.
What is the sequence, the confidential informant is told by, what's his name, Blakely or?
Blakeney, yes.
Yeah. And what was the date of that?
Well, there was an interview of the confidential informant in December of 2003, about a year and a half before the trial began in this case.
And when was the search?
The search was in the actual search itself was on August 21st, 2003. So about 5 months later, about 5 months later, the informant is interviewed, right, and says that Mr. Blakeney told me that heroin in that search warrant belonged to him.
And do we know whether Blakeley has ever been charged with possession of that heroin?
It's not in the record. I believe he was. He's been indicted in a case, and I believe that this heroin is included in that indictment. But it's not in the record, and I'm not 100% sure of that.
But indictments are public information. I mean,
yes,
it's not a secret if he's been indicted. Do you know whether he's been tried and convicted?
I don't. I'm sorry. I don't.
The government must know.
Right? I don't.
Well, I ask them. Okay.
So this, it was submitted in February of 2004 in a wiretap application. Is that the affidavit was?
Yes, the affidavit, yes.
And when was, I'm sorry, I could look, obviously. What was the day of the trial in this case?
April 2005, a year later.
A year later.
A little over a year later.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, and the information was known to the government in December 2003 was when the informant was interviewed and told this information. It was included in the affidavit a few months later.
Yeah.
Were there different prosecutors involved?
That was just what I was going to ask.
You know, I have no idea. I'm not, and I don't want to speak to that. The cases are related. Mr. Johnson, I think, was originally indicted with some other people, and then his case was cut off and separated. I believe it's the same investigative team. I have no idea if it's the same prosecutors or not involved in the case.
Can I know you wanted to start with this, but it looks like you're ending with this. So I just have a question. This the document that you wanted to put in the property receipt.
Yes.
Do we have it?
No. It's neither party made it part of the record.
I see.
I have asked, the defense lawyer cannot find it, and as I understand it, the government cannot find it.
In Kumaris we held that if there's testimony about the document, even if the document should have been put into evidence, it's harmless error. Since all we have is the testimony about the document to describe what the document is, and that was testimony, why would this not be harmless error?
Even if
it's error, which I'm gonna ask you about also. But.
At least two reasons, maybe. You want me to start with why it's error or why it's not?
We'll start with harmless error.
Okay. The jury specifically asked for it twice, not just once, but twice.
I understand, but they asked for it. But there was we don't know what it says other than what was said in the testimony that the jury heard. They could have asked for the testimony.
The testimony said, as I understand it, said that there's a box on the form that says from whom the property was seized.
And the guy says that.
Not the defendant's name.
Right.
Right.
So the jury heard that. What would be the difference?
Well, unlike Kumaris, where it was undisputed, the testimony that the defendant had helped the police in another case. In this case, the defense lawyer got up and said, you filled out this form and it said from whom the property seized and you put in this other name, not my client's name.
Yeah.
And the government then stood up and said, well, you did that because...
Oh, they tried to explain away why they did it. But the document was no different than what... I mean, they said the whose name was on that line of the document. Presumably that's all the document will show.
But I think the jury, which asked for it twice, would be entitled to...
I heard that part, but that didn't persuade me.
That's at least twice I've said it.
Yes.
The jury was entitled... In the closing arguments, there was argument about that very point. The defense lawyer tried to say, look, they put the name on the form not my client. And the government lawyer stood up and said, no, no, he said it wasn't. And by the way, in recross, he said again that that's the name of the person from whom the property seized.
I understand, but
the jury should be able, I'm sorry.
There's no dispute about whose name is on the line and what the box said. There's a dispute about why they put it there, but the document doesn't resolve that dispute.
Well, it might for the jury, but let me it probably would have, since they asked for it twice. They must have thought they needed the document to resolve the dispute. And I think that it's important when he's saying I did it for one reason, there's words on those documents that specific, but it's not part of the record, that specifically say this property seized from, as opposed to the homeowner or who's at the address.
Are those words that you're describing any different than the words that were described in the transcript?
Well,
they are, that we can't rely on them because we don't know what they are. So you're sort of stuck on that.
Right, but the government was trying to say, well, it doesn't really mean that.
Yeah.
And the jury, I think, wanted it to resolve the issue. That's why I think it's important.
Nick, can we just talk about whether it's error for 1 minute?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You're about to say clearly, so I'd like to hear that
yes.
argument. Yeah, go ahead. Well, it's clearly what?
Well, it satisfied every requirement.
Which one do you think it satisfied?
Both 8036 and 8036.
Do you think it's a business record?
Absolutely.
Because it's a police report.
Well, it's prepared. No, not because it's prepared by the person with knowledge at the time. With knowledge, he actually testified that he went and looked at these items before he put them in the
right,
evidence.
But it's part of an investigation of evidence, right?
It qualifies under. It's a regularly.
You think it's under 8036, right?
Yes.
Now I know you're familiar with Melendez-Diaz, right?
That's
the Supreme Court's recent decision on state laboratory
reports,
and ultimately on DEA 7s, right?
Yes, okay.
All right, I'm going to read for you from Melendez-Diaz. This is the Supreme Court's decision in June of this year. Documents kept in the regular course of business may ordinarily be admitted at trial despite their hearsay status. See Federal Rule of Evidence 8036. But that is not the case if the regularly conducted business activity is a production of evidence for use at trial. The analyst certificates, dash, like police reports generated by law enforcement officials, dash, do not qualify as business or public records for precisely the same reason. Why isn't that decisive on this question?
Two things, I guess. First of all, it's not an argument the government has ever made in this case.
Yeah, but
either in the district court or to you or to this court.
Well, this was decided June 25th, 2009. So this would have been a 28J letter.
And it was not.
Nor did you provide it to it. You
well,
did provide two other ones. You didn't provide that
because
one.
Because that's a Sixth Amendment confrontation Crawford case.
No, but it's still, the issue is, does it come under the Federal Rule of Evidence on business records?
Under a Sixth Amendment, well, the whole claim in Melendez-Diaz was comes under Crawford because it's a Sixth Amendment confrontation violation to admit this report. There's no Sixth Amendment confrontation violation the government can argue.
I understand all that. Is there any reason why I shouldn't read this to say what it appears to say, which is that police reports do not come under 8036?
Well, this court has held.
They did, but they held it before the Supreme Court's decision.
But this doesn't give the Supreme, Melendez-Diaz doesn't give any indication that it's overturning this big volume of law existing that criminal defendants can introduce such reports against the government, which is specifically provided for in 8038.
8038, now we're going to a different argument, right?
But
8038 requires findings, right? Factual findings, right? 8038, I don't understand why you would want it to fit under a business record anyway, because then it would go against the defendant as well as, there's no caveat in 8036 that it can only be used against the government.
The defendant has Sixth Amendment protections under Melendez-Diaz.
Yes, but, yeah. Oh, yeah, only since Melendez-Diaz. So I'm not sure what the value of the earlier cases are then.
I mean, I don't think you can read Melendez-Diaz to sub silentio, or whatever the word phrase is, overrule this body of case law that says that defendants can introduce such reports. When a defendant is trying to introduce, there's no Sixth Amendment analysis. When a
this
defendant
is a question
is
of the meaning of the rules of the Federal Rule of Evidence, not a Sixth Amendment analysis. You're saying this came under the Federal Rules of Evidence, which protect the government as well as the defendant against use of hearsay.
There's no hearsay in this. I mean, in the sense that it's a public. I mean,
it's an out of court statement.
Non-hearsay.
It's
as not hearsay under the rule.
If it fits under the rule.
And it clearly fits under the public record.
Right. So under the public record one, it says, and against the government in criminal cases, factual findings. Is it a factual finding?
Sure. It's a factual finding that we found the cocaine in the closet, which is listed on this, and it weighed whatever it weighed. And it was found in room H, and it was seized from not the defendant, another person. That's all factual findings, all made by people with knowledge, because he said the agents brought it all to him, showed him where it was found. He went and took pictures and came back and wrote the report.
Are there other cases where property receipts get in this way?
Well, I mean, if you look in Warren at the what this court said in Warren, police reports are admissible as business records under this rule when offered by a criminal defendant to support his defense. And it's also said in Warren that they were admissible police officers' statements in public records, even in the absence of a demonstration that they reflect personal knowledge. So in Warren, this court said they're admissible under both exceptions to the ASA rule. And I can't, in the context...
Did Warren also say that statements within the report are not admissible if they're hearsay?
Right, but there's no hearsay in this. Manzi wrote this report. He went and looked at the evidence. When the officers told him they found a piece of evidence, he went...
hearsay in the affidavit, that's what I'm asking.
Oh, I'm sorry, this...
No,
you switched to the affidavit.
I switched on you that the... since you agreed with that, I wondered what you do with the affidavit. But anyway...
No, I think the affidavit, so that's a sworn...
The government argues that all of this is, even if it were error, it was harmless error. And what's your answer to that?
The answer is that the jury asked for it twice, but...
That's three times.
At least four, I think. And that it was argued in closing argument, and the jury didn't have a chance to resolve. They obviously wanted the form to resolve this issue. The government said in closing, it doesn't mean, he didn't really mean what it says on the form. And the defense says he did, and the jury wanted that form to resolve that issue to see if they really thought, I mean, the only reason they could have really wanted it is to see whether they believed his testimony or not, that it didn't really mean what it said, I think. And that's why it's, the government has the burden to prove it's harmless, let me put it that way. That's the only reason the jury could have wanted it to resolve this dispute.
What exactly did defense counsel say that this was, this shows that it was not these drugs were not the defendant's?
Well, I think that it was two-pronged, actually. It showed that it was not the defendant. He also raised a number of issues criticizing the investigation, like no DNA evidence and various other things. And this was one more thing. He said
the O.J. Simpson defense.
Well, it's another reason the Brady evidence was important. And this court has held that that's a legitimate, in a case called Brown, I think, a legitimate attack on the government's case is to show the methodology and the things they didn't do is just as important. The absence of evidence is just as important. But here you have a piece of evidence showing that it was seized from someone else, which would have fit in with his theory, obviously. So I think that it was, the government can't meet its burden of showing that it was harmless. I don't have to prove it was harmful, let me put it that way.
But you have to argue why it
yes.
was.
Yes, clearly, yes.
When you say, I'm not sure, when you say it was seized from somebody else, what does that mean? What was the defendant's theory about what actually happened, what the police officer was saying by writing that down?
Well, his theory, I think, was twofold. Saying that they made mistakes in this case, they didn't do things. It also was maybe they seized it from this other person. Maybe the agents thought it was this other person's drugs.
The agents thought about it isn't really the issue.
The agents made a factual finding that it was this other person's drugs when they filled in that box.
What facts? You had the testimony about this. Did the defense make some argument about? What facts were there other than...
The defense did argue about the form, saying that it showed about the seizure list. Why did he put Carlos Williams? Well, no. And he talked about his testimony. He said, why did he change his testimony? Is he trying to explain away something he knows is a problem? Again, the attack on the case. And the government came back and answered that in its rebuttal closing and talked about the 597 form also. So The government said...
There wasn't a dispute that Williams was in the room or anything like that, right?
Well, the wife's testimony, when the agents, a minute after they went into the house and went upstairs, the wife's testimony, Mr. Williams' wife's testimony was that she was in the bathroom when the agents knocked and that he was not in that bedroom when the agents knocked on the door. So...
Williams.
Your theory...
Yes. Mr. Williams.
Under your theory, any time a homeowner in this type of a situation is presented with a return to sign, the agents have to give the homeowner Miranda warnings.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's
He signs it, then he's incriminating himself under your theory.
But he's not in custody. So then the warnings aren't required. He wasn't in custody ever.
Well, did they have their guns out?
Not at the time they asked him to sign.
Wouldn't you normally argue that if in the course of a search with, I don't know, 20 agents, all heavily armed, if they interrogated somebody that that person wasn't in custody for purposes of Miranda, that he didn't think he was free to go?
In that situation, possibly. First of all, there weren't 20. But
how many, 10?
12, I think. But I don't think they were all in the house at the time he was asked to sign the form either. And all he was asked to do is, he clearly wasn't in custody, I don't think.
Did he sign the form for the gun and the marijuana, too?
It was all listed on one form.
Well, the gun wasn't seized in the house.
The testimony was that he refused to sign the form.
Okay. But the gun wasn't in the house.
The gun was listed on the form.
Wasn't even in the house.
No, and the marijuana,
marijuana
was outside too, but they were listed on the same form and listed as seized from him.
Can I ask you, it seems to me that this jury was very conscientious. It first acquits him of marijuana, and it was argued to the jury that there wasn't enough for possession with intent to distribute. So that's an acceptable reason for that. It then convicts on the cocaine, which was in plain view, right?
Yes.
Outside the door of the closet.
It was inside. The way the agent described it, she had to open the door, or he had to open the door of the closet before seeing that cocaine on the floor.
Right. Okay. And then they get hung up on the heroin, and they want additional instruction on constructive possession. Now, it seems to me that the Brady evidence would go to ownership, and although they weren't instructed by the judge about it doesn't matter who owns the drugs, it's whether he had constructive possession, in the government's argument, the government says the defense says they haven't even proven whose drugs these were, who brought them in, how they got into the room or anything. And the first thing said by the government rebuttal is we don't have to do that. It doesn't matter who brought them in. They never say it doesn't matter who owns them. But my point is this, the ownership matter is at least argued to the jury. Now, they're still confused, it seems to me, with this instruction for constructive possession. What is constructive possession? And so if the Brady evidence goes only to ownership, do you agree with that? In other words, this fella could have owned the heroin, and this defendant still could have constructively possessed it.
I agree with that. I don't agree the Brady evidence went only to that, because I think it could have opened up a whole bunch of other arguments and investigations. But let me try to correct one thing. The note about constructive possession came before there were any verdicts in the case. It came
on the 8th.
It came on the 8th, and the jury found the defendant guilty of the crack later that day on the 8th. Page 7 on the transcript of the 8th is the note about constructive possession. And at page 30, 24 to 36 on the 8th is the verdict on the of the guilt on the crack count, and then the heroin is the next. The following weekend.
This note at 3:55. Do we have to return four unanimous verdicts? The only verdict in at that point was the marijuana.
No, there was no verdicts even then.
Oh, even on the okay.
There was no that came after the note about constructive possession.
Right.
And before any of the verdicts.
Okay.
So I think you're right. The main thing about the Brady, the government made these alternative arguments, which they could not have made if Blakeney's affidavit had been revealed, which is, well, it may have been somebody else's drugs, and that's it. But they also made the alternative argument. There's no evidence. They kept saying there's no evidence that these drugs belonged to anybody else or were possessed by anybody else. They made that repeatedly in the closing argument, especially in their rebuttal. They made the argument that the defendant's mother shouldn't be believed, that other people had access to the room. So throughout their whole closing, you're right, they did make that argument, but they clearly emphasized the alternative argument that there's no evidence that supports anything.
If the defense had established through uncontradicted evidence that these were Blakeley's, that he owned these drugs, then the burden on the government would have been quite different, because the government would then have to have established some connection between Blakeley and the defendant, that in some way, shape, or form they were operating cooperatively together.
Sure.
And then there's another problem. I mean, these drugs were not in plain view. They were in a container within a container. And I don't know what the I don't know the drug culture, but you know, if this guy Blakeley had a reputation for violence, and Johnson knows they're his drugs, they're Blakeley's drugs in that room, he's not going to mess with them.
Right, and that's not constructive possession.
I know.
But the government argued in their closing.
Presence and proximity does not make constructive.
And possession. Even knowledge.
But
the government at one point in their rebuttal did argue that knowledge, if he knew they were in the room, that was enough. The government argued that at one point in their closing. They said at page 75 of the transcript, if the defendant did know about them and allow them to be in that room, he's just as guilty.
That's not the law.
But that's not, and
was there
it's
an objection to that?
No, there wasn't an objection, and it's not raised as a separate argument, but it seems to me makes all the clearer the importance of the Brady evidence. I mean, this case is in a whole different light if the defendant can come in and say, the single largest stash of drugs somebody else admitted belonged to him, said, even on the simplest evidence, which is the affidavit, somebody admitted belonged to him, no evidence that the defendant even knew about them or had any role in them. They were in a shoebox inside a black bag in a cluttered room with laundry baskets and clothes all over the place. This case is in a whole different posture for the jury, for the defense and for the jury, and the district court applied the wrong test to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Jasmine, good morning.
Good morning. Looks like I'll need quite a few materials. May it please the court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States. We admitted in the trial court, and we continue to affirm here, that the better practice would have been to disclose the material in the affidavit before trial. But
did you say the better practice, or did you say you should have?
We said in the trial court that we should have disclosed it before trial, but we should have not because Brady requires the disclosure of this statement, which, as we argued to this court, it does not, and we argued below it.
Did you know that before trial? I mean, the problem is your argument after trial is based on some amount of evidence at trial. You knew beforehand that you could have made this argument before trial also, do you think?
This evidence was not material, yes, to the issue of the defendant's.
Regardless of how the evidence came out in trial, regardless of how everybody testified at trial?
The evidence was not material because it did nothing to undermine his possession of the drugs. We could have made that argument before trial, yes. The office policy would have required us to disclose that, and consistent with Kyle's, where we don't want to tack too close to the wind, we should have. But this was not.
How do you define material?
Material? Well, the question is whether the impact that the undisclosed evidence might have had on the fairness of the proceedings.
Mm-hmm. At various points in your brief, you say, well, this was only tangentially relevant, right? What does tangentially relevant mean?
Tangentially relevant means that the question, the real question, the relevant question before the jury was whether we had proved all of the elements of constructive possession as to this defendant. The question of who also may have had a possessory interest in the drugs with the defendant, or who put them into the room, was not the question that was before the jury.
There's no such thing in the federal rules of evidence as something that is tangentially relevant. Evidence is either relevant or it's not relevant. And this evidence, however it might come in, is clearly relevant. It made it more likely than not that the defendant did not possess the drugs. That's all, and that was a fact of consequence, and that's all the rule of relevancy requires. Now, when you say it's not material, you're talking about something other than relevancy, even though your brief uses that term, tangentially relevant, which I don't understand. But the evidence, in order to qualify under Brady, does not have to be so powerful that once having seen it, the jury would have said to itself, this man is not guilty. That's not the test.
That is true.
But it can build, and if it undermines part of the government's case necessary for the government to make, then that's sufficient. And that's the way I read the cases. If it shakes your confidence in the verdict, then that's enough. You agree with that? I mean, that I think that's the law.
That the evidence must shake one's confidence in the verdict, yes. This evidence did not rise to that standard, however, because it was missing a very critical component that even Mr. Kramer admitted immediately to this court. It lacked an admission that immunized Mr. Johnson from knowledge of the drugs.
If he owned it, he possessed it. That's a proposition that you would agree with, I think. But if he didn't own it, he might have possessed it anyway.
Yes.
But the fact that he didn't own it was powerful evidence that he didn't possess it. May not be conclusive, doesn't have to be.
It does not undermine our confidence in this verdict in light of the strength of the evidence that he in fact did exercise dominion and control over the contraband that was in the room.
Other than his proximity, what is that evidence?
Well, that evidence took four forms, and they're all equally significant. I'd like to begin by pointing out that he was there in the early morning hours, which is something that this court's case law has repeatedly said the jury can look to as one factor. I'm not arguing to this court that his mere presence was enough. But then let's look at what he was doing in the room. He was found without a shirt on. There was a gun found outside the window, the only window overlooking the yard, the only window that the gun could have come out of, that had been previously, the jury could have found, wrapped in a T-shirt, whereas the appellant was bare-chested. The logical inference is that the appellant has thrown out the gun out the window because the...
Agreed, yeah.
Okay. So we now have the appellant linked to a gun that we have expert testimony says that gun... One thing that people that are storing drugs, that are keeping them in a safe house, that they are using to protect, that is the function
of that
gun.
It goes to the crack cocaine in plain view. I'm just wondering where the powerful evidence is with respect to the heroin.
Well, we have him in the room with the heroin. One can infer that if he's in the room and he's...
That's where this evidence comes in and would come in is... You could also infer that if he ever messed with Blakely's drugs, that Blakely would kill him. If they were Blakely's drugs. Because, see, as I said to Mr. Kramer, the case takes on an entirely different character if the defense is able to establish that the heroin is not his. Then the government has to prove, it seems to me, that there's a connection between him and Blakely.
Well, we are now starting to, Mr. Kramer was really starting to speculate, and we're really running to start very far afield about assuming what alternative evidence would have looked at. Bringing us back just to the affidavit itself, we can already show from the language that was used in the affidavit that these men knew each other. He referred to him as Scirocco. This is not a random stranger. This is someone that they are known to each other. Then the other evidence that was disclosed, that the mothers of these two people are talking about this, and the mother of Blackney says to Scirocco's mother, well, he's just going to have to take the beef for this. There was, even if we're looking just to the four square corners of the affidavit, and I would like to talk about the admissibility of
but
the
that evidence is exculpatory. He will have to take the beef for this. That, it seems to me it can be used, could be used very effectively by the defense counsel saying, take the beef. That means he's not guilty, but he's going to take the fall for something that he's not guilty of.
I disagree. I think it ties the two of them into a drug a drug distribution deal together.
Was this Blakely? Was Blakely indicted for possession of this heroin?
I don't know if this particular quantity was included in Blakeney's indictment. I know that there was a long-term investigation going on into drug distribution in that neighborhood, and Mr. Blakeney has been indicted, and he did plead guilty, and his case is over. This search warrant was elected to be tried as a standalone search warrant.
Well, he pled guilty?
Mr. Blakeney pled guilty.
So he has no Fifth Amendment claim with respect to this, is that right?
I don't know when he pled guilty, but I know that now he has pled guilty. I don't know when at the time of trial, I don't believe that he had pled guilty.
Had he been indicted?
I believe he was, but when I was speaking to the trial assistant, I did not specifically ask about the timing of that indictment.
Do I understand you to say that you don't know whether the indictment included the heroin that was recovered in this particular search?
No, I did not.
You don't know one way or the other?
No, I don't. I could find out if the court would like.
I would like to know.
Okay, yeah. I can find out.
Before you send anything to us, share it with Mr. Kramer, and then send us.
Yes.
Send it to us.
I might
have misread the briefs. I guess I was under the impression, maybe in reading this or below, that the government was suggesting that the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't know about this, but that the FBI did. That's not really right, is it?
The record is really unclear about that.
Unclear because the title, this affidavit, who filed the affidavit?
The affidavit was from Agent Dan Sparks.
Right, but agents don't file. Right.
It was filed by an assistant, right. Clearly, organizing that. Yes. So at the time that the wiretap affidavit was filed, clearly somebody in the office knew. Yes. But the trial assistant who is present has indicated that she does not recall being privy to that.
Is the search warrant that authorized the search of these premises, is that in the record?
I do not believe that it is.
Do you know whether the affidavit accompanying that search warrant mentioned heroin?
I do not know. I mean, while it is true that, this evidence would have been helpful, we never tried to prove who owned these drugs, and we focused our entire case on the ownership at the time of the search warrant, the ownership and the constructive possession at the time of the search warrant. And for that reason, the statements in the affidavit simply were not material.
Well, they're material in the sense that if it had come in, the government could not have made the alternative argument that maybe it belongs to him, right? They could only have made the argument, if this had come in, the government could only have argued that it's Blakeney's drugs, but this guy is in cahoots with Blakeney. They could not have made the argument that it's his drugs.
I don't want to quibble with the meaning of his drugs. I mean, if he's...
His meaning the defendant.
Yes. Well, we still could have argued that he constructively possessed the
yes,
drugs.
Yes, I understand. But you couldn't have constructively possessed because he owned them, but rather only because he was in some relationship with Blakeney. It would have changed the nature of the government's argument.
Yes, it would have. But we never disputed that there could be others that also had an interest in the drugs. You know, and indeed, the defense put that out there already. You know, they had testimony from Mr. Johnson's mother that said that other people were in and out of that room and essentially inhabiting it.
But you did doubt, you drew into question the credibility of the mother.
Yes. She also was involved in narcotics trafficking as well, so she was impeached. But that evidence was out there, and the defense did make that argument. So what they're left with is, you know, incrementally more evidence tying the drugs to another person in addition to appellant.
Well, not really incrementally. If the government swears in order to get a Title III that this is true, then it's more than incrementally. Government really could not challenge it later.
Well, the fact of the affidavit is admissible. There are, I believe, as was discussed earlier when Mr. Kramer was arguing, you know, there are three levels of hearsay in here. You know, Blackney's statement, which is the third and innermost, would come in as a declaration against penal interest. But we still have the statement from the confidential informant to the swearing officer, which does not fall within an exception. So we have the affidavit being admitted, but the statements within it couldn't necessarily be offered for their truth, but the fact that they were said.
Well, a statement against interest is offered for the truth, against penal interest, right?
Yes, against declarant.
Of course, you don't know whether Blakeney, this would open up all the interviews that your agents had with Blakeney during the time of the plea negotiations for his guilty plea.
It could, but it's, if there
you can't,
was...
You can't tell us now that he didn't actually tell the agents during those proffer sessions that it's his drugs.
I've spoken with several prosecutors. I have no reason to say to this court that anybody said that Scirocco was...
No. The things that are said in the affidavit, it's quite possible that he did say those things. With respect to himself.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you just say a word about the, or more than a word, about the jury instruction? I take it you concede after our decision in Wheeler that it's an unlawful jury instruction, an
yes.
erroneous jury instruction.
It is an erroneous jury instruction.
How much after Wheeler was this? Was this case tried after Wheeler?
I believe that it was.
Take it the office is going to try to get the right jury instruction from now on in these cases.
I am sure that we are going to try to get the right jury instruction, but we are on plain error review here before this court, and I think that it is significant that no counsel below thought that the instruction was plainly erroneous because all of the instructions do refer.
That's all. You can make that argument in every case where there's no objection below.
This is true, but I'd like to focus on these instructions in particular here because they're the ones that are important. They are circular, and they do refer back and forth to each other, but the concept that they circulate around and keep referring to is the concept of possession. And since this was the entire issue that was critical to both sides, I think it's fair to say from the silence of both counsel, we can conclude that both of them thought that the language in the instruction also required the defendant to have possessed the weapon in addition to using it.
Prosecutor says in the opening and I think in the rebuttal, closing arguments, that it's use or possess, that either of those is sufficient, right?
Yes, she used, I think, used, carried, or possessed.
Used, carried, and or...
the language of the statute.
Correct.
Yes.
Right.
But we are here on plain error review, so we have to ask, is it a miscarriage of justice to let this conviction stand? And in light of the way that the evidence came in and where the only issue was in dispute was the possession, I think that there's no, it is not a miscarriage of justice to conclude that the jury did not convict him simply because they thought the gun was in the room near some drugs.
Well, there's no discussion, though, in the closing argument. Don't pay any attention to the use claim. why couldn't the jury have thought that it's sufficient if they're there to protect the drugs, since that is what the instruction seems to say?
There is a possibility that the jury thought that. I cannot argue to this court beyond a reasonable doubt the jury, no juror thought that. But that's why it's important that we're here on plain error review, because that's not the test for reversing this conviction.
Well, how about also the charge which went to the jury in the wrap-up said, you may find the defendant guilty of using, carrying, and possessing a firearm, so that's all three, during a drug trafficking offense, if the government proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed any of the alleged drug, and that the defendant also possessed the firearm. So he leaves off use, carry, there.
Yes, he did, but there's no argument from the defense that there was an
error. Well, what I'm saying is this makes the improper charge on use, the general charge on use, more harmless, because he is saying to the jury, you may find him guilty if, on this 924C, if you find that he possessed. He doesn't say, and that the defendant also carried, used, or possessed.
That is correct.
He emphasizes possessed.
And then he
goes on to say, in other words, you must all agree that the defendant possessed the firearm in connection with at least, and then names the drugs.
Yes, that was the point that I was trying to make to Judge Garland. That same point the judge made again in the instructions where he explicitly defined use, carry, and in furtherance of. The jury was told, after the concededly wrong definition of use, that to use the firearm in relation to the drug trafficking offense means that defendant's possession cannot be accidental or unrelated. So again, that is yet a second time that the concept of possession was underscored. So the theory that I understand appellant to be postulating, which is perhaps the gun was lying in the room and, you know, it was near the drugs and that's what drove the conviction, is simply not a reasonable presumption in light of the instructions' repeated emphasis on possession. And
before you sit down, periodically I say what I'm about to say and hope that maybe it'll ring a bell at the U.S. Attorney's Office and ultimately the Department of Justice and then Congress. There used to be a doctrine called the concurrent sentence doctrine. Now, he got 87 months on the heroin charge and 120 on the crack cocaine. If we sustained the crack cocaine and we were back 25 or 30 years ago, we wouldn't even consider the heroin thing because of the concurrent sentence doctrine. It wouldn't have any effect on the sentence. All of that changed because Congress passed this law requiring special criminal assessments of $100 a count. And so he was not only sentenced to the time in prison, he was also assessed at $100 for each one of these counts. So all this argument about the heroin business is because there's a $100 assessment against him. Well, I just don't understand why the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office don't go up to Congress and say, look, you know, abolish that. We don't collect it anyway. And all these, we would protect a heck of a lot of convictions and save the Court of Appeals a heck of a lot of trouble because invoking the concurrent sentence doctrine. So anyway, I do this about once a year. This is my speech for the year.
well, thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I would
Well,
ask.
In connection to that, I have one. Suppose we agree with Mr. Kramer. I don't know what your position is. At least I didn't get it out of the briefs, whether you think the Brady violation goes just to the heroin count or to all of them.
The Brady violation would have to go just to the heroin count. I cited to this court's opinion in Arucci for that proposition, where that was the case where the a witness who testified as to three out of, I believe it was nine counts, there was Brady information as to the testimony that she provided for certain counts but not for others. And this court said that the Brady violation would only affect the counts about which she provided testimony. Using that analysis, it would apply only to the heroin.
And where was that in your reply?
Arucci? It was in our...
Where was that in your brief? Is that the footnote at the end?
Let me turn to my index. I did not. It's at page 31, 32, and 38.
question. All right.
The first full paragraph, the informant's statement implicated Blackney only in the ownership of heroin. The informant said nothing to connect Blackney to the crack, the marijuana, or the firearm.
What
the
page
statement
is that?
Page 38. I apologize, Your
page
Honor.
38.
This statement thus left appellant solely responsible for the contraband and plainly was not exculpatory with respect to the allegations that he possessed the crack, the marijuana, and the firearm. That's on page 38. It's the the full paragraph there.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Mr. Kramer, you want 2 minutes?
Thank you. Judge Randolph, I hope you don't think that I am arguing that it only affects the heroin count. It clearly affects the crack. The government, I never read either in the district court or this court, the government to argue that it doesn't affect the crack count also. And it clearly has to affect the gun count, because the gun count, you don't know which underlying drug conviction the jury based its gun conviction upon. They were told they had to be unanimous. If they based it upon, they returned this conviction with the heroin count. So if they based it on the heroin count, that clearly has to be reversed. The government never argued in the district court or this court that it affects only those counts. They never made that argument. They just argued that there might be sufficient evidence otherwise. This affects the whole. If the defense was these were other people's drugs, if they could show that the heroin somebody else admitted, they clearly would have the better argument that the crack also did not belong to him. It would have put the crack also in a totally different light. Judge Garland, this case was argued about 3 years.
Because it showed that other people had access to the room?
It shows other people had access. It shows other people put drugs in there. It shows it could have been somebody else's gun. It shows it affects every count. It does not just affect the heroin count. I hope.
How does it show it could have been somebody else's gun?
Because if the drugs belong to somebody else, it could be somebody else's gun.
It clearly doesn't matter who owns the gun. The theory about the gun was throwing it out the window, right?
Right. Now, there was a juvenile in the room.
Can you possess a gun? Can you not possess a gun that you throw out a window? How can that possibly be?
I'm not sure. The government kept arguing that it was used. The government's argument in its closing, in its rebuttal, was it was used.
If he threw it out the window, didn't he have to possess it? I mean, tell me how he gets it out the window without possessing it.
It's certainly not an argument the government has ever made in the case.
That wouldn't necessarily mean he possessed it in connection with drugs, because he could have had that to protect himself.
Right, and I think that's probably why the government never made the argument. They've never made the argument either in the district court or this court that throwing it out is possession. It may be dispossession.
He had to pick it up to throw it out.
Well, it could.
Pick it up in the room.
It could. Well,
cocaine was in the room.
I mean, there's certainly. This gets back to the whole thing. There's certainly, you're right, there's a logical inference that it could have been him. There's also an inference that it could have been the juvenile, or it could have been the husband who was not in the bedroom when this happened. The government's really arguing a sufficiency of the evidence test for Brady, Brady issue.
You said the government didn't argue that it only goes to heroin. The point that the assistant just referred us to is on page 38. The informant's statement implicated Blakeney only in the ownership of the heroin. The informant said nothing to connect Blakeney to the crack, the marijuana, or the firearm. The statement thus left appellant solely responsible for this contraband, and plainly was not exculpatory with respect to the allegations that he possessed the crack, marijuana, and firearm.
But that's not saying, that's an argument about the materiality. That's not saying, it never says you should affirm those counts because it did. It clearly puts the whole case in a different light. You can't
No, you're talking about two different. One is whether they have a winning argument, and one is whether they made the argument.
Well, it was never made in the district court, and I don't read this to make that argument. That has to do with the materiality. She goes back, correctly
this
concluded.
This is on the Brady argument. This is in the section of her brief about Brady.
It is, but it starts the page before correctly concluded that the information was immaterial, and then it goes further.
That's Brady.
Right, but it's not saying that you should only goes to the heroin count. It's going to why it's not material for the whole case. They never say that you should. Let me put it this way: in the conclusion or anywhere else in this brief, does it say that you should affirm, even if the Brady claim is correct, you should reverse only the heroin count? and not the crack or not the gun. It never says that anywhere or comes close to saying that.
That's a strategy question about how to argue a case, but it does sound like they're at least making the argument. It may not be a winning argument, but it seems like...
This
is the intention of the writer, and I suppose neither of us are able to analyze that without an X-ray machine or something.
It seems to me you would make it very clear if you say, and the court, if the court finds this to be a Brady error, you should still affirm the crack conviction. I don't know how you could affirm the gun conviction because you don't know which underlying offense that's based on.
Well, they came back with a verdict on the crack count before they had decided whether he was guilty of the heroin count.
Right, but the whole defense argument, the defense was stuck with the argument, trying to tell the jury, somebody else put it here. Well, we don't know who that is. Somebody else put all these drugs here. It was not somebody put the heroin and somebody put the crack. I mean, it was an all-encompassing argument. The defense then can say, look, we know that this heroin belonged to somebody else. Of course, the crack belonged to somebody else or was not possessed. But I mean, that's a powerful argument you can make if you know that the vast majority of the drugs belong to someone else. I mean, it's not you can't separate that smaller amount of crack out and say that didn't affect the defense strategy. Of course it affected the defense strategy about all the drugs and the gun. And I still don't read that to say that. I did want to say that Wheeler was decided about 3 years after this case was tried.
Oh, after this case.
But in a case called Toms, this court had already held this instruction erroneous, which was decided about 10 years before, shortly after Bailey, that it was decided. And the government cites no case from this court or any other court upholding a 924C conviction where there's no other independent gun conviction. The only cases upholding them, there was either a possession by a felon or a possession of a pistol without a license. But the Brady issue is all-encompassing in this case. It clearly affected the entire defense strategy and the government strategy of trying to discredit the defense strategy that these drugs were possessed and belonged to someone else.
Ever any argument made that because he threw out or evidence that he threw out that the marijuana and the gun were thrown out together, that went to show that it was only the marijuana that he knew about in the room? I mean, he knew about the gun, he knew about the marijuana, whoever threw the gun out the window, and there was evidence that...
I don't recall that argument being specifically made. In earlier it came up, but of course he was acquitted of the marijuana. We don't know why the government didn't ask for a lesser included simple possession instruction, so we don't know. I mean, it's only speculation that it was because it was not for distribution.
Well, that
it was a small
argued.
Amount.
That was argued.
It was argued in one sentence in passing, and the government never made an argument to counter it. Speaking of speculation, the government says, I'm speculating about what could have happened with the Brady evidence. Of course, that's the whole point. That's why it should have been turned over before trial, because now I'm left with trying to tell you what could have been done, and a number of things could have been done. It's not just better practice to turn it over before trial. It's constitutionally required. The question now is whether it's reversible error, obviously, but...
Aren't those two questions the same, though?
Well, not if you
in
read...
In light of the way Kyle's is written, is there a difference between you should have turned it over and... If you should have turned it over, then it's a Brady violation.
Well...
If you shouldn't... It's not a Brady violation, then you don't have to turn it over.
The Department of Justice has just issued a revised Brady policy, which is much broader than materiality, and seemingly acknowledges that before trial, the obligations of Brady are greater. The question about whether you get a reversal is a separate issue, but that its Brady obligations go far beyond materiality. If you read district court opinions in this circuit, which for reasons don't get appealed because they're in the discovery phase of criminal cases, district courts interpret it much more broadly than material. Because they say before trial you should be...
Didn't the Supreme Court really resolve this by saying that there's no true Brady violation unless it was material?
No violation, but I think there's this... Maybe the Department of Justice even acknowledges there's a separate difference between obligation and violation. The obligation pre-trial is different than whether there's a violation after trial. But in any event, this case isn't close to the line.
Right.
Thank you.
And Ms. Chasson, will you remember to submit both to the defense counsel and to us what Judge Randolph requested? I can't remember what it was. Yes, sir?
The indictment.
Yes, may I have a week?
And whether this heroin was included in Blakely's indictment.
Yes. May I have a week to submit that?
Yeah. It's okay.
Actually, if we could get the plea, what he was convicted of as a consequence of the plea and when that was, that would be helpful.